Well, hello. It's the end of the week, almost. Not that I'm looking forward to the end of the week. No, by no means. It's been an interesting week, though. It's time for The Nose here in studio with us. Tanisha Dugan, producing associate at TheaterWorks. Tracy Wu Fastenberg, director of development at Covenant Preparatory School. And Carolyn Payne, actress, comedian, we'll be here all day. Actress, comedian, dancer, founder, director, choreographer of Kinetic Dance, and that's just scraping the tip of the iceberg. All right, so a little bit later in the show today, we're going to talk about Mindhunter. That's a new series on Netflix. I could tell you who the stars of Mindhunter are, but their names would mean absolutely nothing to you, probably.
Unless you're a Broadway person.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. If you're a Broadway person. But before we do that, we've got a couple of other topics here. In the first segment, we are going to talk in just a bit about a new offering from Amazon, which feels that they are not sufficiently embedded in your life yet. We'll tell you what that is in just a second. But we're going to begin in February or so of next year. The Super Bowl will happen. There will be a halftime show, as there always is. The NFL has now invited Justin Timberlake to be the performer, or perhaps a performer, at the halftime show, which wouldn't be all that interesting, except that, of course, 13 years ago, the world was set on its collective ear, although I've never quite figured out why. But there was, of course, the famous wardrobe malfunction and involved the then very young Justin Timberlake and Janet Jackson. So obviously one of the big questions is, well, if Justin Timberlake can be rehabilitated and invited back to the Super Bowl, and he being, when you really get down to it, the bodice ripper, can the rippy also be invited? And we're going to talk a little bit about that. Tracy Wu Fastenberg, I'm going to have you sort of kick this off I'm also trying to remember, like, you guys are all kind of young. I don't know. Like, how old were you guys in 2004?
Thank you.
2004.
Freshly out of college.
Yeah, 24.
I was, like, in college.
Right. I mean, I sort of lived through this whole thing as a CBS employee, so it was very, my battle scars are very different from yours. But,
mine was, it's a boob.
Right.
Yeah. It's a boob.
And I mean, I am a performer, so, mm-hmm. I mean, it happens.
Right.
And like you said, I don't think no one really saw the boob as it was actually happening.
Right.
It was the posthumous boob.
Right. I mean, it really, if it had happened before people had the capacity, and people were using, I think, video cassettes at that point as opposed to DVRs, mm-hmm. if people didn't have the capacity to tape things and rewind them, you know, on a pretty large scale, I'm not sure we would have even known about this. I certainly was watching that halftime show. I had no clue that anything like that had happened.
Right. I actually went searching for like a YouTube video or something, because I was like, I can't exactly remember. I remember seeing it on the cover of, like, you know, People or whatever, and of course they had blocked stuff out and everything.
Yeah, I remember the picture of, like, her.
Yeah,
the,
and
the
that's all
moment.
You can find. You can't really find, like, somebody.
If you squint really hard, you can
might,
see.
Can yeah.
you see?
Well, all right, so let's.
You can see more detail.
Yes.
But, you know, you don't see a whole lot of, like, 27,000 YouTube videos that people uploaded then of it. So I feel like it's sort of a, we're making a big deal out of nothing, guys.
Let me do a poll, because I find people are not in agreement about this. Intentional or not intentional?
You go intentional.
Maybe
not both parties, but okay. I think one was intentional.
Do you think that was rehearsed?
Tiebreaker.
I think, like, it was not intentional for the nipple to be exposed. But I think that there was, like, something maybe that was supposed to happen. Like,
right.
I thought maybe it was, like, a tearaway costume that went wrong.
Right. So maybe, like, more things got torn away than
right.
had been. That's probably about where I am, too. I mean, apparently in the control room, Wolfie and McPants are both saying totally intentional. Totally planned. So I think I'm in.
Yeah, but she's not that good of an actor, and I love to see her act, but, like, her face was
so genuinely, like
appalled, shocked, as it happens when you have
a real. But that's why I'm wondering if it might have been intentional on one side.
Wait a minute, are you putting down her performance in the crumps? Because I won't have that, all right?
Did you see the crumps?
No, I didn't
Eddie Murphy, thank you.
So, I mean, the other question about this was, okay, so there are a whole bunch of narratives that went around along with this at the time. And so one of them was that in some way Janet Jackson was blamed for it in a way that Justin Timberlake wasn't. There are people who also think that maybe it was Janet Jackson's plan. There are other people who think, well, no, it's sort of blame the woman or blame the person of color or blame the woman of color and not the white guy. And I don't know. What do we think of all that? Tanisha, I kind of know already what you think of that.
You do. You don't, but you think you do.
Well, based on the emails we exchanged.
Well, that first thing was about who is the greater icon, which is sort of what I took away, which is probably unintentional. But I was sort of like, icon status, Janitor Justin, that just seems like an odd comparison to make. But I think, you know, Janet is, I think that black female sexuality is a very difficult thing for America to take. And when they see it, they just don't know what to do. And even whether intentional or not, there's a lot wrapped up in black female breasts, from, you know, feeding a nation to, not to bring up Harvey Weinstein, but to this kind of awkward, uncomfortable, violent history. So I think that is subconsciously embedded in this conversation ultimately. And I think that's why in our emails when I was like, we all know what this is about. I mean, we do. Mm-hmm. We don't want to say we do, but we know what it is. No. That's kind of where I come from, where like we know what this is. And of course he's going to be alleviated of any pain having dealt with that non-issue. And that she'll be carrying that burden, because that's just what it is.
Well, it's also her body. Mm-hmm. You know, it's her body that was exposed. She's going to have to deal with it on that level as well. Mm-hmm. And also, I wonder if age comes into play at all, because he was very young. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she was a full-grown woman at that point. And so it's probably easier to blame the full-grown woman of color than the young, you know, precocious
Disney kid.
Exactly. Right.
For a perspective, he was 23, she was 38.
They could be dating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, so Carolyn, one way that we can sort of figure out how the NFL, and the NFL, by the way, they're the people in charge of the halftime show.
Great.
It was not CBS. CBS is just in charge of the telecast. So CBS got the $550,000 fine, which I might add they never had to pay. But we know how the NFL processed this because we know what they did for the next 7 years, which is they had like old white men on stage, with the exception of Prince, 2 years after the Nipplegate or whatever you want to call it. Prince was the halftime act. But other than that, it was like Paul McCartney, Bruce Springsteen, The Who. I mean, a lot of these people aren't even from countries where they previously had football, although of course they do now. But they invited men. Fergie, I think, in 2011 was the next woman to get up on that stage with the Black Eyed Peas, and that was a horrible price to pay, as far as I was concerned, for any kind of pop redemption that the Black Eyed Peas were the halftime show. But never mind. I mean, I in some ways I think it's hard to separate woman of color from woman or person of color from woman of color, but there was something about they didn't want any women on stage for a long time, you know?
Oh, because boobs are scary.
Yeah, because I guess, what did they think? This was going to become like a trend? Like everyone was going to line up to expose their nipple in the Super Bowl halftime show?
That was almost a spit take just then. That was brilliant. Yeah. I mean, that's such an interesting stat. I guess I never really paid attention to who was really the halftime show. Yeah. It was just like, yay.
The Super Bowl is so low down on my like radar of things I'm...
Except for Left Shark. I remember you loved Left Shark.
I do love Left Shark. And like, honestly, like Left Shark I would hire for a second as a dancer in any show I'm doing.
In some ways, if it took all of this just to get us Left Shark, it was worth all the time.
I agree.
But I think ultimately what we're talking about is the NFL as family fair. And sexuality is not family fair. And so we feel like male sexuality is not sexual, without being able to explain it in a different way, but that we don't have to sort of shield our children's eyes or be concerned while we're all drinking beer and eating wings and really half paying attention while our kids are sitting in front of the TV, that we don't have to worry about what may come up if it is a man, which is just an awkward, weird.
Yeah, because then there was that year that Madonna did it.
Right, which was some distance from...
Right.
Yeah,
that was...
Might have been 2013, 2014, something like that.
Somewhere around there. And, you know, she just had herself surrounded by all these sexy young men, and she was there like, you know, a Beneva commercial for arthritis medication trying to dance around these, like, sexy young men. But you don't often see the reverse of that. Like, I don't think... Right. If you were a male artist, if Justin Timberlake was like, my plan... 30 sexy women dancing around me. They'd probably be like, let's pump the brakes.
How clothed are they?
Yeah.
I mean, it's all sewn up. Is everything covered? You
know 30 sexy about. Women and I'm going to run by
what's
and
that,
reveal
what's that
each
really
one
like
of
iconic
them?
Music video with the girls and the guitars?
Oh, with the...
Robert Palmer?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I think there is precedent there, but maybe not for
right, that's what I'm saying. I feel like the Super Bowl
I mean,
is going
to... Since that time, there have been another number of notable women performances. And of course, Beyonce debuted Formation mm-hmm. at the Super Bowl mm-hmm. halftime show. And there was some pushback there in places like
God,
you know,
I
Fox
mean,
News.
Could
like
you
that.
Imagine her doing that show after this whole, you know, first half of the season and the national anthem yeah. debacle? Like, there's no way that she would be allowed to do any portion of Lemonade during a halftime show
so,
at this particular juncture.
So this is the second part of this conversation, which we're going to have to do pretty quickly. But so the NFL is in crisis mode right now. They still haven't really figured out how to deal with people taking a knee and the anthem and all this kind of stuff. There are heated meetings going on all over the place. I really recommend ESPN the magazine's long form piece about this. It has all kinds of amazing stuff in it. And one of the things that's clear from that piece is that in the NFL offices, you know, they've recruited a lot of interesting people who are young, people who are women, who are really good at public affairs and public outreach and maybe helping the players get some of the social causes that they want attention drawn to and interested in maybe working out some compromises. And then there are the owners who are plantation owners, basically, as far as I can tell. I mean, they really are. Their mentality, particularly Jerry Jones and Dan Snyder, some of the people, and Bob McNair, who surface in this piece, is these guys who just have no interest whatsoever in what any players' concerns are, especially black players who are concerned about Black Lives Matter, anything like that. And so now they've got this, they know this conversation is going to start, right? The conversation about Justin Timberlake and Janet Jackson. And so that's the next question. Okay, I'll pull the table. In between now and the Super Bowl, I'll start over here with you again, Tracy. Will they invite Janet Jackson?
I wish they would, but they're not always known for doing exactly the right thing at the right time, so doubtful.
All right. Denisha?
First, I got to say thank you for being a white man and saying that so blatantly and clearly, that they are, in fact, plantation owners, and they are very comfortable with that, and there is no reckoning about that being their status and the way in which they earn their living.
Well, Bob McNair, the owner of the Houston Texans, at a meeting with other players— this meeting that was chronicled by this article said, we can't, this is a terrible situation. We're letting the inmates get control of the prison. That was his metaphor for talking about the players. So anyway, continue.
So thank you for that, because I think that's important and it helps to shift some things when that happens. I think ultimately we're in a really capitalist, greedy, amoral time. So I wouldn't be surprised at all if she showed up.
Thoughts about the money. So, Carolyn, you have a solution.
I
do.
Yeah, I said if I was staging this, I would have her there as a surprise and flip the tables, have her cause Justin Timberlake to have a little wardrobe malfunction.
Would you just pull his top off, or are you talking about pulling his pants down?
I don't know. I mean, I think there are like different ways you could handle it, you know?
So many options.
Yeah, so many options. And I mean, I guess it would
could
be
do a
like
Prince Bum action.
Yeah, ooh, yeah. Right. You know?
She's homage. Referring to the fact that well before this, I think I was just told on the screen 13 years before this at the MTV Music Awards, Prince performed with cheek revealing pants.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. Yes, and then Howard Stern.
It said assless pants on the screen, and that's
oh
not quite right. But that's not quite right.
No, they were buttless. Yeah. I don't think there was anything between the cheeks. So I think that would
right. But I still reject that term. I mean, he had and you know, see what I'm saying here. It's not that
I see what you're
it's
saying.
Not that he was less.
What had
that.
Happened was
yeah.
It was that you could see it. Anyway, so anyway, that's a possible solution. I think it's a great idea. I don't know if they'll be smart enough to do that.
If she comes up like they the Venus of DeMilo, I'm totally into it.
Choreographer right
I'm
here.
A choreographer.
Right.
You know.
Right. So if you're listening, Jerry Jones, and he loves this show, I mean, he usually probably won't listen to the podcast until this weekend. But if you're listening, Roger Goodell, Jerry Jones, I know you're big fans of the show. I can get you in touch with Carolyn Payne. Mm-hmm. I want 10% of something, but I don't care what.
Left Shark will make an appearance.
Right.
As well.
Yeah. So we have to move on here because Amazon feels that it is not deeply enough ingrained in your life. They have a new plan. They have a new service which they're offering. It's called Amazon Key. It involves a couple of pieces of hardware that you don't have right now. One of them is something called an Amazon Cloud Cam, I believe, and then a special kind of lock. And what will happen is that when the delivery person, the Amazon courier, shows up with your much desired package of granola bars, which apparently Tracy with Fastenberg. Is it granola bars?
Everything.
Everything.
Sadly, I'm sad.
And you're not there. You're not there. Instead of dropping it on the porch so some shady character can make off with it, which we'll also talk about as well, the door will open ultimately. The door will open. That person will be able to come in, deposit your thing, and then you leave. I mean, so Tracy, part of the problem here is there's a tremendous – first of all, would you do this?
Absolutely not.
You would not do this.
No, and I –
even though you order a lot of stuff from Amazon.
I order a lot of stuff from Amazon, like to the point where my husband just looks at me and goes, again, what's now? Right. What is it now? And it's everything because I'm a full-time working parent. I don't really like going to stores, and it's just easier that way. But there's no way I am giving anybody access to my house, and there's no way I'm giving some random – camera access to my home because there's a way too much preschool streaking happening in my house anyway. But
preschool streaking, so my preschooler, you know, she's three.
And so
they're not going to show it on the Jumbotron at the halftime show.
You never know.
But I just don't want
anybody knowing, you know, being able to click in a malfunction, anything like that. I don't want somebody else in my home when I'm not there. Even if I risk, you know, losing my granola bars.
All right. I don't think we're going to get anybody to endorse this, but I mean, people surprise me all the time. Tanisha, you
It's going to be a hard one to endorse, although I did watch a video of somebody talking about it and being like, I mean, come on. You either get your stuff stolen off your porch or you just let this, you know, delivery man in. And I'm like, the stuff stolen off your porch? Like, they give you returns, like refunds off of that. So
You could lose your box or you could lose everything in your house.
Yeah, I just don't quite understand that level of concern for an order. But maybe Amazon is losing a lot of money in refunds to packages that don't actually get...
So they'd rather employ a fleet of drivers? Because something about it's only Amazon drivers that can be in your house. It's not your FedEx guy or UPS guy or anything.
Right.
Although Amazon wants to expand this and hopes that you'll use it in other ways. And the other thing about this, I don't know, I read a little bit more about this. I mean, it turns out that Amazon already has things like dog walkers and house cleaners. There's a whole home services division of Amazon. So ultimately, you could let all kinds of people in.
Do they have babysitters?
I don't know. You really want an Amazon babysitter anyway?
Yeah.
I mean,
is that a serious question?
Yeah. Dog walker?
So here's where I kind of stand on. So my neighborhood has suffered from a lot of porch package thieves. It's something that I follow on the West End Living Facebook group, which I'm probably going to get like kicked out of now for revealing the inner workings of it. It feels like every day someone's complaining about their package getting stolen. And recently I had a package opened and the person decided that what I ordered wasn't good enough.
That's really hurtful.
It. Yeah. Yeah. I was like, fine, I'll take my mermaid tail, my Halloween costume. But they left it there. It was like open. They had opened it up, like looked at it and were like, oh, this is pathetic. And like put it back in the box. And
well,
left
if you're
it
a professional
porch.
Thief, a mermaid tail is not that useful to you because you need
to be able
to.
I don't know. The West End also had an umbrella thief like a year or so ago. Yeah. Who was stealing.
But what's the resale market
and
on
maybe
an,
this
a mermaid
is
tail?
Just a city thing. You know, I don't have that issue. And we order a lot of stuff from Amazon.
Right.
And we've yet to have anything. I mean, knock on all the woods, right? The holidays
now
are coming
up. Now people are like,
but
where
like,
does this girl live?
We've never had that
so
issue.
So, like, here's my thing with this. Like, I live in a multifamily house. So I have a door that doesn't lead into, like, my home proper. So would that be, like, would this involve that they could just kind of get the package inside my front
foyer?
Door, the foyer.
And how would your other folks, the other tenants, feel about that too?
Well, we don't share a door.
I mean, even the common area.
Well,
I think this is an interesting question because, I mean, the vast majority of people who have porch thefts are people who are living in the way that she describes or in apartment buildings. I mean, and not always in the city, too. I mean, my son was living in a place for a while where, I mean, you know, you really wouldn't want to try to deliver a package there. But, I mean, this service seems much more set up for somebody with a $475,000 house, right? I mean, you're going to have this camera in there and this very special. I mean, there's two brands of lock that you can use. It has to be one of these two brands. I mean, I don't think anybody,
I feel like it's got to be even bigger than that.
Yeah.
I know, like, this sounds very odd, but it feels like it's really meant for people who have staff. And so, like, having someone to open the door isn't strange because there are plenty of people who open the door.
Right.
And you can't just get the staff person to show up.
Like, let's say I ordered furniture or something from Amazon. Would they also assemble it? Like, could that be, like, the next level for this? Because that would make it very interesting.
They might have that service, actually. Oh, well, I feel like I've seen that.
I should have been using that.
So the person, I mean, in some ways...
A life where you do nothing. You don't shop. You don't put anything together.
You don't even bring your package inside. Somebody else is going to do it.
Yeah.
Listen, not to tell tales out of school, but one day she showed up here with, she's got a watch that's sort of like my Fitbit, and she'd taken 375 steps all day. And it was like, it was 8 o'clock at night.
All right. That's true.
And that's hard to do. I mean, Stephen Hawking takes more than 375 steps a day. So,
done it again.
But so, I mean, I think that this is sort of, I mean, almost literally a Trojan horse. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think they really care about this that much. Obviously, they would, and I think, Tanisha, you're right, that the kind of person they're talking about is a pretty upscale person who, you know, has a lot of people looking after them in various ways. I mean, I don't know whether they have staff or not. But I do think that what they want is to get inside your house. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not inside your house. They want you to have that camera for lots of other reasons. I mean, they're pretty open about that. Mm-hmm. There's even a thing where you can have one of their cameras in their closet, in your closet, and it'll watch what you're putting on and stuff like that.
What?
I mean, it's an extension of Alexa, and Alexa never turns off. I mean,
right.
Oh, yeah.
And
we have one,
so
and it's creepy.
It's a very weird way to set up a surveillance society and trying to introduce it to you as a service, which I think that to me is the scariest thing. And I think that's why instincts for them, like, absolutely not. I will never have this, even if I do have a staff of 10. I'll just make that person show up and pick up the package, because I just think that there's a certain level of privacy that we all should demand.
Right. And it's interesting. You guys are comparatively, as I pointed out at the beginning, a kind of young panel for us. I mean, you're all pretty young. And you people are the people who are supposedly surrendering up your privacy much more readily, right? I mean, you're willing to communicate about yourself on social media and stuff like that in a way.
But we're not. I mean, that's a whole other conversation.
Right.
But we're really not.
but
yes.
But if anybody should be willing to do this, it should be you and not paranoid baby boomers like me. So if you guys don't like it, that's an indication that they have a ways to go. But what they want, I don't think they care about whether you get those particular packages. They want to get inside your house in every possible
way. When you put it that way, that is the most disturbing.
Right.
Right. You know,
those boots are looking a little old. Here are some suggestions for you.
Exactly.
You're running low on diapers. Should we add them to your cart?
Well, and Facebook does that anyway.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, it's just you mention something, you're talking to somebody, and then you like look at your phone and there's an ad for that. That is uncomfortable.
I'm going to sound like such a conspiracy theorist, so please excuse me. But I just think it is all an attempt to make a society that does not think for themselves, does not do for themselves, mm-hmm. does not question or wonder or have to be accountable to even themselves. It's just so creepy.
It is creepy. I will tell you this. I bought a new laptop last weekend. I didn't buy it through Amazon because after I had researched everything and read all the reviews and everything, I was more confused than ever. And so I just went to Best Buy and found some random guy and said, what should I get? And he said, get this. And I was done.
It's like the video store.
Right. I'd read thousands of words of reviews by this point. And then I wound up, this guy said, how about this? It just came in. I said, okay, fine. So it's a pretty new, it's a very new laptop. And when I started it up, it turns out to have a new feature where the minute you boot the laptop up, these little red lights start blinking next to the camera, and it does facial recognition on you, and that's instead of typing in your password. And it was all happening as I was like introducing myself to this laptop. It started blinking. I said, well, wait a minute.
I don't want to get to know you that well.
Right. I don't want to do facial recognition. Like, but it was too late. I mean, like, it had already taken a picture of me, and now that's how I get to use my laptop if I look enough like myself. I mean, there's sort of a default feature that's another. But
which
I thought,
aside, it's the reason why I have no intention of. I actually think I might leave iPhone, and I've been with iPhone since they first came out. Mm. The facial recognition's got me like,
right?
No thanks.
And I do feel that. I mean, that you're right. Basically, I don't know exactly what kind of mind control they want to do, but they certainly want to be in our lives, taking pictures of us and, you know, knowing a lot more about us and how we look like what we look like when we get up in the morning and log onto our computers than we want them to. All right, I'm getting ordered to take a break. We got to talk about Mindhunter so we can scare you even more. All right, we are back. Mindhunter is a relatively new series on Netflix. It is the story of one or possibly two FBI agents who are in the late 1970s pioneering the idea of profiling. They don't even have a good term for serial killer. They call them sequence killers because serial killer just hasn't taken off yet. And so you're watching that process unfold, and they have a lot of meetings with, well, sequence killers. You're going to hear a conversation between the young protagonist, whose name is Holden Ford in the series, and a guy named Ed, just a regular guy named Ed, except Ed is a mass killer. He is, in fact, the actor embodiment of a real mass killer. So they're in prison talking back and forth. You'll hear Holden, and you hear – and the first person you hear, though, is Ed, who is this towering but kind of lump of a serial killer.
Well, I'll be honest, I don't get many visitors. When I do, you think they want to talk about this shit. It's like if you worked at a slaughterhouse with livestock, real conversation stopper.
Did you?
No, I'm just saying people who hunt other people for a vocation, all we want to talk about is what it's like.
Right, sure.
It's not easy. Butchering people's hard work. Physically and mentally, I don't think people realize you need to vent. What are you writing down?
Oh, I just think it's an interesting choice of words. Vocation.
Well, what would you call it? A hobby? I'd say it's more than that. Look at the consequences. The stakes are very high. Is this helping? Are you getting what you came for?
I think.
Good.
Can I just ask you something? Do you believe the prison can help you?
Are you kidding?
You think you shouldn't be in prison?
I think it's shutting the barn door after the horse has bolted somewhat.
All right. So, Tanisha, I feel like this is one of the strangest series I've ever watched, and I've kind of toggled back and forth between liking it and disliking it. I guess I want to hear everybody's just overall take on how they're feeling about Mindhunter right now.
So I probably won't be picking it up after these four episodes, but I am not into crime series in general, so I don't know if this is actually for me. And I pitched this to my dad, who is like a avid Law & Order person, like so much so that he watches the reruns and like knows the words. He's seen them so many times. yeah, exactly. So I think that there's probably a universe where that where it's interesting to that kind of watcher, and also something that they talk about in the series. I think it's also something that people who love like 48 Hours or the first 48 would be into also. But for me, I'm actually just interested in how people find these things. And maybe it's because I'm still connected to the cord. Like I'm a cable television watcher. Absolutely. And so unless a think piece comes around that goes, oh, you should pay attention to this thing happening on Netflix or Hulu, I would like never know it existed. So I guess, yeah. So I will not watch it, I don't think, again. Although I think my partner probably is into it. So I may be watching some of it through osmosis. But yeah, not my...
Well, in a way, though, like in a way, Tracy, I feel like this series kind of violates a lot of the traditions and norms of series like Law and Order. I think I sent the first email I sent about this. I said I really don't need ever again to watch another scene where there's a woman's body laid out on a slab, and there's one detective who's just like step for step with the ME, and the other detective's out in the hall retching. And I mean, like, there's so many conventions that we've seen, and this series is kind of not like that. In some ways, it's more a series about guys talking about stuff, and it's more a series about how bureaucracies function, and more a series about the weird status of the FBI in our society, which is really different from a lot of other law enforcement agencies. I think it's only kind of marginally a series about the thing that it's supposed to be about, but that could be just me.
I don't know. I think it's about both. I mean, I was sitting there Googling, you know, various sequence killers like Mr. Kemper, and sort of like, I remember reading about him, you know, in college because I was a criminal justice major, but I don't do that anymore, so sort of lose a lot of that, you know, all of that learning. But I thought it was really interesting watching the characters interact, and I think one of the things we talked about is how it, whether it's unintentionally or intentionally hilarious, because some of the conversations were just so, just like the pace of them, the tempo, the actual words were hilarious.
Well, that conversation we just heard was pretty funny.
Oh, yeah.
It also upends a lot of norms. In other words, you know, I mean, there's so many conventions and iconic scenes that we're very familiar with. And, you know, I mean, one of them obviously forever is Jodie Foster going to talk to Anthony Hopkins, where Hannibal Lecter is very withholding. You have to earn every little disclosure that he's willing to give you. And we have kind of the reverse of this. We have this big, lumpy, kind of irresistibly, you know, loser kind of guy who's his big thing there is that most people don't want to talk to him about what he really wants to talk about, which is butchering people.
He's dying to talk about it. He loves what he does.
I think that actor is spectacular. He's my favorite. The show was at its best for me when he was on screen.
His name is Cameron something. I can't remember what it is. Yeah. But yeah, he's terrific. It's a very weird cast, too. It's a cast of, yes, obviously, if the young lead, the guy who plays Holden Ford, was in Spring Awakening, and then I think he was George III in Hamilton. But, I mean, in terms of, like, known people, you know, I mean, you might recognize the woman from Fringe or something, maybe. Right. But, I mean, this is not, it's not
you
an
all-star cast. You recognize
the
executive producer before you recognize any of the faces on the screen.
So
true.
This is a David Fincher jam. We haven't said that name yet.
And Charlize Theron.
Yes, and Charlize Theron. And I think tonally, I mean, we were talking out in the newsroom before this, like everything that David Fincher makes is basically a horror movie, right? I mean, like The Social Network was a horror movie. It just was about Mark Zuckerberg. And so, but this, I don't know. Do you, first of all, are you agreeing that this is funny? I mean, that this is
funny? Yeah. I kind of feel like it either should have pushed one way or the other. Mm. Like, I do think that it has a lot of funny moments. But it was like kind of it's kind of that humor where it's done, it's just kind of like thrown in there to pepper it up a little. I felt like, to me, this I had a lot of trouble with the first episode. Like there was just it dragged. Like I had trouble getting into it. But the second and third, I was like, okay, I see where we're going. But the scenes with Kemper, where he's interviewing Kemper, and these moments of the little like comedy and the way it's done, I think the comedy is done so well because it's so dry, like, and it's just stuck in there, and you find yourself laughing during a show that you don't expect. But I'm not hooked on it. I agree with Tanisha. Like, I'm not gonna go out of my way to watch any more of this. Like, I don't really have. I wasn't grabbed in, and I am a crime and like anything with murder, I will sit and watch. Like, I watched Making a Murder in one sitting. There's this really fascinating show right now on Oxygen about the disappearance of Maura Murray, which, like, she was a young woman about, I think we were about the same age, and she just disappeared one day. She drove up to New Hampshire and her car was found, but they never really knew what happened to her. I've been, like, sucked into this documentary on TV, and, like, I will sit and watch crime stuff. And this, I felt, and there was nothing, the moments of humor were there to, like, hold my interest or attempt to, but it either needed to have more excitement, more humor. There needed to be something more.
I see. I think I need to clarify that the reason I'm not watching is because it actually is creepy to me, and I don't like creepy TV.
See, I feel and like
so
it's
I think
not
it
creepy
definitely,
enough.
Like, it's, yeah, it's totally creepy to me. And I think it's creepy because it does do what with Kemper, it humanizes these individuals in a way that I'm just not ready to, like, absorb, you know?
He's
like,
human. I mean, he's still incarcerated. He's still kicking around there.
I would argue that this is also, it's very much a movie about a period, so it takes place in the late 70s. It was interesting as last week I was talking about 20th Century Women, which takes place at almost exactly the same moment of this movie. It's a time of great social change, and the FBI always kind of lags behind anyway, right? There's sort of this sense that, I mean, in the opening episode, young Holden Ford meets a much more bohemian, I mean, anybody would be much more bohemian, but he meets a more bohemian woman in a bar who's going to become his romantic interest. They have a little back and forth. And at one point, she says to him, you look like a Mormon. And of course, he does in terms of how he's dressed and what his haircut is like, and none of it's really appropriate for the late 1970s. If you sort of think about depictions of other FBI agents in movies, and particularly, say, like Willem Dafoe in Mississippi Burning, where he really looks like a Mormon. But there's that sense, right, that these FBI agents, they're just lagging behind every possible cultural index. On the other hand, they're trying to figure out what's going on. They're trying to figure out what's going on with social change. And so to me, a lot of the conversations that they have, sometimes with serial killers and sometimes just among themselves, are maybe about very traditional kind of men in the 1970s just trying to figure out what's happening right now. So with it, actually, let's play a little clip of this. This is so eventually Holden, the young man, is paired up with a younger and far more traditional FBI agent named Bill Tench, who really does have that kind of FBI crew cut and is smoking so constantly that it kind of drives you crazy after a while.
It does. It does.
And forget that people could smoke on airplanes.
Right,
like that
exactly.
Was,
yeah. So here they are.
In the dark, huh?
We are. I have studied everything we have to offer. I've taken this ride out here with you, listened to everything that you've been kind enough to teach me, but I still think we are talking about something that we don't understand in the slightest.
I was trying to help you. If you don't like it, go back to your bedwetting college kids and we'll forget all about it.
Ada Jeffries and her son were killed for reasons we are simply not equipped to understand. It wasn't lust murder. It wasn't some random thrill killer who was born bad, and it wasn't a panty thief who wanted to change things up. It was an aberration.
Let me tell you something about aberrant behavior, Holden. It's aberrant. If we understood it, we'd be aberrant too. Fortunately, it's not incumbent upon us to write a dissertation.
Well, maybe we should.
You know, it has been being suggested to me from the control room. There are also once again, this is an unusually young nose group. I'm not sure 1977 or 1978 is necessarily all that meaningful to you guys. You know, I mean, it in a way, the way that this looks, it looks back at a time that it hadn't really occurred to me, but you probably hadn't been born yet or something, right?
Right.
Yeah. No. But I think what was interesting to me in that first episode was the fact that there was so much like easy sexual harassment happening, it just like hit in a way that I was like, I think this was okay then, perhaps. Like, I don't know. Are they trying to make a statement? Because it's clearly not, it doesn't seem purposeful. So I think there's a lot of that nostalgia of the time period that is lost on me. And it had me questioning a lot more, which is maybe why I also felt detached from it. Because I just was like, I don't know if you're trying to make a social commentary on what's happening now or if really things were.
It wasn't as blatant as, like, say, Mad Men, where it was like in your face. The sort of behavior where they sort of like smacked you again with it and saying, look how different it was, you know, but it was just, it wasn't subtle though either.
Right.
It was just like a touch heavier than that. Mm-hmm. So,
I mean, I've been struggling with this series too. And I think I am going to stay with it just because I'm so interested in somebody trying to do something different with this. And I think they are teasing at some really interesting things. I mean, and maybe another one of them is the kind of weird status that the FBI has in our society. You know, they're not like police. I mean, in some ways, they are more differentiated from society than any law enforcement agency. There's a way in which they really exist kind of apart. And when they're depicted in movies, that's often the case. They exist kind of apart. They're almost not one of us. And on the other hand, we've never really settled in our mind what that means. Are they – in some ways, I think we see them at certain times as – instruments of true justice and people who really believe in a code. You know, I think that's true right now with James Comey and Robert Mueller. There's this sense that these guys will stand up to anybody, you know, and that they really believe in their institution, and anybody who tries to mess with it is going to be in a lot of trouble. But we also remember J. Edgar Hoover, who would, you know, compromise people. You know, one of the panelists just crossed her fingers when I said that. And, you know, J. Edgar Hoover. I mean, the other way that we understand them is the man in some of his worst, you know, extremities. I mean, in some ways, you know, Mississippi Burning is about FBI agents going down there to enforce civil rights laws and try to help the civil rights movement. But we don't always see the FBI that way, too. And so there's a sort of an otherness that they're exploring there.
There's an otherness, and I think, you know, what I hope doesn't happen with this series, and it seems just starting to be teased out, is that there is in fact an aberrant nature to one of the agents.
Yeah.
And I am interested in an imperfect man in these positions. I'm interested in that. But I also am not interested and don't want to go into the idea that in order to fight crimes, you have to in your heart be a criminal too, and it feels like it's going
in that.
Yeah,
in order to understand monsters, like there's a part of you that has to be a monster,
like Dexter type of thing.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, as an actor, I always say that, you know, someone said, you know, there's a little. I may have been Dreyfus actually, who said that there's a little Hitler in all of us, and I think that is to a certain level true. But I don't know how engaged I am in the idea that these officers of the law that are you know, hierarchically above a police officer can work beneath and around the law in a way that allows them to sort of delve into their worst behavior, which is, seems to be happening with the Jonathan Groff character in a
right.
way.
Right. Well, and I think, you know, the thing with, like, crime dramas, there's nothing, there's just so many and there's been so much. There's not a lot new you can do. And I think the whole push with this show was that this was going to be, like, a new take on it. And I think that that's where it fell short to me. Like, I felt that there was a lot that, especially as they started to tease that and this character. I don't think there's a whole lot new that you can do.
I mean, they achieved it structurally for sure.
Sure. You know, but you definitely always think about the law enforcement officer who has the anger problem or the drinking problem, the coping mechanism problems. And so you just hope it, I understand, hoping that it doesn't go down that path. But I believe that he's also, I mean, based off of
the people who wrote the book.
Right. So, so I think that there's, hopefully there wasn't like an over-dramatization to make it, you know, more scintillating to the rest of us. And I like the fact that there's a historical aspect to it. Mm-hmm. And there's sort of that research aspect and the fact that, you know, how criminal justice and sort of the philosophy behind it has evolved to include a little more sociology as opposed to black and white, cut and dry, because that's sort of where we see a lot of butting heads even today and when we talk about the justice system and criminal justice and incarceration and all of that. So I think it's sort of timely in that respect.
Jonathan is reminding me that the Scott Glenn guy in Silence of the Lambs, the profiler guy, is based on this guy, this real guy who wrote this book. And the other series that this so closely resembles that I'm like the only person on earth who watched was called, I think, Manhunter or Manhunt, the Unabomber. And this also ran this year. It was on Discovery, I think. It was like some weird channel like that. And it was about the hunt for the Unabomber. It had a very similar kind of dynamic to it in the sense that it was about a real-life FBI agent, the guy who really did track down the Unabomber and who turned out to be, in certain ways anyway, a little bit more like the Unabomber than he was ultimately comfortable being. And to me, that's one of the – I mean, just to go back to the notion of drama, Tanisha, to me, all of these things ask kind of the Macbeth question, which is – were you going to be that person no matter what, or did you turn into that person because of the circumstances into which you drifted, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you could come down on either side about Macbeth. You can come down on either side about this character, the Jonathan Groff character here. Was he always this kind of weird guy, or did he get weirder and weirder because he was working on this?
I think that is the beauty of the series, and I think that's why it creeps me out and why I don't know if I can stick with it, because I think it does, in fact, go down that path of our darker selves and asks us a lot of questions in a way that a Law and Order is much more pat in its structure. Mm. Here's the crime. We're going to solve it. Hooray. This really is, you know, a character study about it seeming like Jonathan Groff, but also about these men. We have yet to see a woman yet. These men who commit these massive crimes. And in a time like this where we are always sort of trying to find the answer, it's an interesting study.
All right. Wait, we should take a break here, so we'll have plenty of time to recommend things to you. That's Mindhunter. So depending on how you feel about it, if you love David Fincher, you kind of have to watch it because it's the latest expression of Fincherism. Anyway, we'll be back to recommend.
Today's show was produced by Jonathan McPants, with help from me, Kyon Wolf. The part of Bill Curry was Tito Jackson. On Monday, we'll be back with news from over the weekend on The Scramble. And now, back to Colin.
All right, so here we are. We're moving towards the end of A Wonderful Nose with our apparently very young panel. No, we didn't even notice this until they came in here. Tracy Wu Fastenberg, Tanisha Dugan, and Carolyn Payne. So it's time to recommend things to you. Why don't we start over here with Tracy Wu Fastenberg?
So the school that I work at, Covenant Preparatory School, recently lost our founding board chair. He passed away, and he was sort of an amazing gentleman in the fact that he did everything he could to help our boys sort of change the trajectory of their lives. Excuse me. And he lived in a way that was sort of like stuffing like 5 years into one bag, you know, for a day. And I sort of want to encourage everybody to do that. He did that in a way that not only framed his interests, but also and his success, but also was always a handout to somebody else to help them up, and expecting a lot of himself and of other people. And so, just sort of a reminder that, you know, as we go about our daily lives, to add something else and maybe do something else for someone.
All right, that's an unusual recommendation and one that we appreciate, I think.
Sure. Well, I love being told I'm young at 35. So holla at that. I'm actually going to endorse. Something because I have not pulled the plug. And so this is a cable series, and I'm going to endorse The Woman and the show. Showrunner Tanya Saracho, which is just amazing to say because you don't see too many of hers running shows and executive producing. And the show is called Vida, and it will be premiering in 2018. So look out for that on Stars, because it's just kind of incredible. That story, and she did a fade for us at TheaterWorks, and so shout out to her and her success, because that's pretty awesome. And the obligatory, but I love also, The Wolves is happening right now. If you want to see 10 women talking about what it is to be a woman today, and some soccer in there too, come check us out.
I'm very excited. I haven't seen it yet. It's directed by my friend and collaborator, one-time collaborator,
that's
Eric
true.
Ort.
That's
so
true.
I can't wait to rush over and see it, but I haven't gotten there yet.
All right. I am endorsing, first of all, as the show I mentioned, that Disappearance of Maura Murray is really fascinating, and it is an interesting look at true crime, and the woman who is the host of it and kind of delves into the investigation. She's an NPR producer, and she's about the age of what Maura Murray would be now had she not disappeared. So she has a very interesting perspective. So check it out if you're a big fan of true crime.
And what network?
It's on Oxygen, which is such a weird thing to be endorsing. But
they're trying to change it up, though.
Yeah,
over there,
yeah.
So.
They're trying to not be the budget Lifetime, and I think that this is an interesting direction for them. So definitely give that a look. And also, I want to endorse the 5x5 Dance Festival is coming up next weekend, November 4th. There are dance companies from all throughout Connecticut performing, and there are, if you are a dancer, there are master classes, and then they are doing site-specific performances and some talkbacks, and one of the talkbacks I will be at talking about the creation of my Nutcracker Sweet and Spicy, and it's different, and what makes it so different, and why it is a interesting part of the Nutcracker history.
And where do we find this? Where does it happen?
You can it's at St. Joseph College on Saturday, November 4th. So you can just Google 5x5 Dance Festival at St. Joseph.
That sounds very interesting. All right. I'm going to endorse, first of all, a column by Roger Cohen of the New York Times. Roger Cohen of the New York Times, his column usually isn't in the physical paper of the New York Times. He writes from Europe, often about European issues. I think he's kind of underplayed a little bit. He has a wonderful column today called A Quiet and Modest Life. It isn't really about one thing. It's about a lot of different things, and it's very much about how to live. And anyway, I would just endorse tracking that down online, A Quiet and Modest Life. And then, I mean, maybe I don't even need to endorse this because we spent all of Tuesday talking about it, but I will endorse Rags at Goodspeed. I mean, it's really kind of a lovely little...
Thanks.
Sorry. Well, I mean, there's...
No,
you know,
I didn't have to do it. No. That's awesome.
So it really is a kind of a lovely I went down there, as I said before, on a Friday night, and I was kind of in a bad mood. It's like, it's the end of the week. I got to go to this play. It's going to be long. It's kind of – and then it really was kind of enchanting. I mean, it's about some very serious things, and I suppose there's some ways that I could actually kind of pick it apart a little bit. But on the whole, I just found Charles Strauss's music and Stephen Schwartz's lyrics to be wonderful. It's a great cast. And so, yes.
I'm going to cast some shows, that Ruggiero.
Yeah. Yes, that Rob Ruggiero guy, he does know what he's doing. So those are my two endorsements. I also quickly, if you read The New Yorker, the piece about the Sackler family. The Sackler family are these incredible philanthropists who have rooms named after them in every great artistic or cultural institution in America. They're also basically the people who started the opioid crisis, according to this article. That's where they got all their money. I didn't even realize that OxyContin, the word contin, it's continuous. That's what it actually means. Maybe that's like an idiotic eureka moment. I didn't realize what content meant in OxyContin. Anyway, lots of other little tidbits like that in that piece. All right, thanks to Carolyn Payne and Tanisha Dugan and Tracy Wu Fastenberg. Thanks to everybody else who worked on The Nose. We'll be back on Monday.